Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 10th, 2025, and our friends Richard Wolf and Michael Hudson are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
When it comes to the conflict right now, the economic conflict between the United States and China, many people are asking what is the main strategy on the part of the Biden administration? And here is the way that the Treasury Secretary of the United States, Scott Bessent, is talking about it.
Fortunate that the Chinese actually don't want to come and negotiate because they are the worst offenders in the international trading system. They have the most imbalanced economy in the history of the modern world. And you know, I can tell you that this escalation is a loser for them, that they have some very smart, the economists, the academicians, technocrats within their bureaucracy, and they would be telling the leadership that we do not have the edge here. They are the surplus country that.
Yeah. What's your take, Michael? Let's start with you. What's your take on the way that the Trump administration is trying to talk about the strategy on their part? Even we've heard that CNN was reporting with talking with GOP Senator Ron Johnson. He said he has no idea what is the strategy. What's your take on that, Michael?
Well, when Bessent said that China had an unbalanced economy, what it meant was that it was successful. And him, for his idea, a balanced economy is one without any government, and ideally for Trump, without any income tax. But that's not how China looks at it. China believes it's a mixed public-private economy with the government playing the same kind of active role that it played in the United States industrial takeoff in the 19th century, and that it played in Germany's takeoff, and earlier in British mercantilism. China knows that it already is the central provider and refiner of many raw materials that the West needs, and that if indeed it says we're not going to be bullied, which is what its foreign minister has said, we're not going to negotiate when somebody says we're going to hurt you if you don't want what we say, we're going to raise tariffs and prevent you from trade. China's gone rope-a-dope. It says okay, we're on with that. You want to balance the trade more with us? Well, we're stopping our exports to you of critical materials. We're stopped. We have a whole list of products that we're not going to send to you. These are the products that your industry needs. Without importing from China, American industry, after a few months of depleting its reserves of parts, pharmaceuticals, various chemicals, raw materials, the American economy will have to stop producing. And China has said, well, we're now going to need licenses to get the critical materials that we can produce. And China has the ability to stop, to interrupt America's production relations and assembly lines and just stop things. So it says fine. But I talk often with Chinese policymakers, and their view is not that they will lose from the United States, but they think the United States is committing economic suicide. And mostly they think that America is going to end up the loser in this tariff war because it doesn't have an industrial policy. Simply imposing tariffs isn't industrial policy. It merely makes it more expensive for companies to import from their affiliates automobile parts from Canada and Mexico, as we've discussed in past programs, but also telephones and iPhones made by Amazon that are made there. shoes from Vietnam that are imported by the big shoe company, screws, all sorts of things. And China sees above all that, you know, why is America not recognizing why China has been so successful in developing what Americans call unbalanced? And that is because China has kept public infrastructure in the public domain. It hasn't let it been privatized. And the most important public utility that it's kept, that neither America nor other Western countries have kept in the public domain, is money. China doesn't have a domestic financial class that makes money by speculating and buying out other companies, buying out industry and deindustrializing, or deciding, let's find a cheaper way of doing this to lower the wage costs and make more profits. The whole aim of China is what used to be the aim of the United States, Germany, and other countries. You raise wages in order to increase productivity, and you provide basic infrastructure to provide basic needs, electricity, communications, you know, railroads, at cost or at a subsidized rate, so that the industrial companies don't have to pay their labor high enough wages to afford this services that are monopolized in the United States. So China has made finance part of the industrial growth pattern, and Trump and the United States is not, and Trump doesn't realize why China is developing, but America isn't. He simply says they're developing and we're not. They're ahead of us, and that makes them the rival. We have to stop them. He doesn't say, why don't we're doing what China's doing? Why don't we follow their model that's made them so successful? And the irony is that this model that has made China so successful is exactly the same model that the United States followed in the 19th century to develop its industrial takeoff. It's a model that Germany followed in the 19th century to follow its takeoff. There's a certain logic of how do you industrialize? And you industrialize with a mixed economy, and you take the banking system and you use it to finance industrial development, not to create monopolies and create trusts and essentially try to make money at the expense of industry and the rest of the economy. There's no recognition of an industrial policy to back up industrial tariffs. So the result is that Trump thinks that he'll win the war with China, and the Chinese say, well, we're looking at who's trading what and who needs what. If he wants to do that, let's let him go right ahead and do what he's doing, and we'll see where the American economy stands in 3 months.
Richard.
Well, you know, just to piggyback off what Michael said, it's embarrassing. I listened to that clip of our Treasury Secretary, and it's embarrassing what comes out of that man's mouth. I mean, I'm beyond words almost, but let me try. Why is he calling what the Chinese do somehow self-evident? They're technically smart people, he said that, are aware that they shouldn't be doing this, what they're doing. Let me remind everyone, 70 years ago, China was among the poorest countries on this planet. It was an exemplar of the depth of poverty. It was the place that Pearl Buck described in her book, The Good Earth, as almost beyond human suffering, the level of difficulty for their people. And over the last 75 years, and particularly over the last 30 or 35 years, they have become one of the economic powerhouses of the modern world. Why in the world would you want to call that not what it is, what Michael says, success? Of course it's success. They've become the manufacturing center of the world in that period of time. They are the, I mean, it blows my mind. I recently saw a map of bullet trains in China, the complex network of their super fast trains. The only thing in the United States that comes close is the Acela, the train line that runs from Boston to Washington, which is only slightly faster than the convention. We basically have no bullet trains. And they've connected every place in China with bullet trains. By the way, Michael reminds us, what was the big breakthrough of the 19th century? The trains, which unified the country, which opened up the Midwest to the rest of the world so it could become the food producer, the grain producer, transforming everybody else. The Chinese are the success story of our time. You know, earlier government administrations in the United States wanted to make the Chinese change their regime, change their system. We justified bringing them into the World Trade Organization because that was going to make them like us. But there's no reason for them to be like us. They don't want to have slow economic growth. In 2024, according to the IMF, U.S. economic growth about 2.8%, Chinese economic growth about 5%. And now I know there'll be the conventional nonsense about how you can't trust Chinese numbers. I have heard that story uninterrupted for 30 years. Now it's beginning to fade away since obviously it was nonsense all along. And it's nonsense now. And by the way, those are IMF numbers, not numbers from China. So the crucial reality here is that it's the American government that's in trouble. It's the American empire that's declining, and it's the American capitalist system that has dug itself into a hole. If for the last 40, 50 years, you have run a trade imbalance, which we basically have since the 1970s, and you've paid for it by a massive export of dollars that come back as debt. You're deepening a level of debt that will one day lead people to hesitate to absorb more debt. That's what happened on Monday of this week. That's why the bond market freaked them all out. Look, it destroyed a British government two or three prime ministers ago when Liz Truss tried to push beyond the level of debt that people will give London, crippling that economy still further. They're in trouble here. And the imposition of tariffs, I mean, let me take another way of getting it. The president of the United States declared economic war on the whole rest of the world by a tariff on every country, with a handful of exceptions. Nobody has ever done that before. What is this? This is not a sign of a calm, collected. This is desperation economics. And if you doubted it, the on again, off again just shows you how desperate they are. 2 days of something, Monday it has to be reversed because the bond market goes crazy, and then Wednesday it has to be reversed because our allies are going to hurt us back, the Chinese showing it, even the Europeans, courageless as they so often nowadays are thinking maybe to find some resort. But this is not the United States of the 20th century. This is the United States going down and flailing around with these gestural policies on again, off again. Wow. This is, and the whole world, one last point. The whole world has been given a gift. My old teacher, Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, would have told me to expect this. Mr. Trump attacks the world for cheating and hopes it will get him by doing what he's doing. What he has given is a gift to every other leader of every other country who will now be able to point to the economic problems of his or her country and blame Mr. Trump. He has taught them. And there'll be a grain of truth to it because the tariffs make a difference, hurt people in his country, and they're going to yell in every country. And their leaders are going to have to blame someone, and Mr. Trump has shown them how to do that. Blame him. And there'll be more truth to their doing that than there was to Mr. Trump, who initiated it. As Mr. Hagel would have said, his plan was to burden the rest of the world and make them pay for the problems he has. His result, they will blame him. The opposite is buried right in what he did. And he doesn't seem to understand any of that, and he keeps doing it. 90 days we're to wait. In other words, the uncertainty of the last few weeks will now be for the next 3 months. What? May, June, July, nobody knows how to make an investment, where to make it. You won't know what the supply chains are because you don't know where the tariffs will or will not be, or for how long they'll be, or for what height. How do you make a decision? You don't. You wait. And as Mr. Keynes told us, when the employer class waits, we all discover how capitalism makes the mass of us hostage to what the few of us do with their profits. If they don't roll them over and spend them, we're screwed. And suddenly, what are we looking at? Stagnation from the holding back, from the uncertainty, coupled with inflation from the tariffs, and we get that stagflation horror that comes back to haunt us. This is chaotic economic policy born of desperation, whose likely outcome is going to be a lot of trouble.
I don't think it's born of desperation at all. Trump is not desperate. He is quite confident that he has a solution to the problem. And I think if we take a step back, we realize that this whole tariff issue isn't really about tariffs at all. Trump and the Republicans have one political aim above all others, and that's what is behind what he's doing. They want to cut taxes, above all for the progressive taxation that falls mainly on the highest incomes and on personal wealth. And it seems that at some point, Trump must have asked some economists whether there was any alternative way for governments to finance themselves. He said, how do we cut taxes? What can we do? And somebody must have told him that actually, from the time of American independence in 1776, all the way through the eve of World War I, by far the dominant form of government revenue was customs revenue from tariffs. So you can see that a light bulb went off in Trump's brain. Tariffs don't fall on his own raunchy A class of real estate, financial, and monopoly billionaires. Tariffs fall primarily on labor, also on industry for imports of necessary raw materials and parts. But the whole idea of introducing tariffs is, he said, the more tariff revenues we can raise, the more income taxes we can cut. And right now, before Congress, the Republicans and Trump are saying it's time to renew all of the vast tax cuts that Trump enacted in his first administration. That is what pushed the U.S. Budget into deficit to begin with. Trump claims that tariffs can enable the United States to keep his tax cuts and replace the taxes. And he wants to cut taxes even more on the wealthiest classes, as if somehow this is going to create an incentive for the wealthiest classes, the financial classes, the monopolists, the real estate people, to rebuild American industry. It's as if giving more wealth to the financial managers, they're the ones who've deindustrialized the American economy. Giving them more money will simply repeat the industrial takeoff that was peaking in the 1890s under the president that Trump idealizes, William McKinley. Well, what his narrative leaves out of account is that tariffs were merely the precondition for nurturing industry by the government in a mixed public-private economy, just like China has a mixed public-private economy. The government shaped markets in ways that were designed to minimize the cost of living and doing business. And that public nurturing is what gave the United States its competitive international advantage in industry. But given Trump's guiding economic aim to untax himself and his most influential political constituency, what appeals to him is simply the fact that government didn't have an income tax. It was able to finance itself through tariffs. Why can't it do it today? And it's as if all that enabled America's remarkable industrial takeoff to occur was cutting tariffs. And also, what appeals to Trump is the super affluence of a robber baron class, in whose rank he can imagine he thinks of himself as joining the ranks of the robber barons. And this self-indulgent class consciousness has a blind spot regarding how its own drives and predatory income and wealth destroy the economy around it. It's as if the robber barons made money by organizing and driving industry. Trump is unaware that the Gilded Age of the 1890s did not emerge as part of America's industrial strategy for success, or that the great fortunes were made possible by the failure to regulate monopolies and the failure to tax rentier income. If you read a book, Gustavus Myers, History of the Great American Fortunes, tells the story of how railroad and real estate monopolists were carved out at the expense of the economy at large. And the Democrats and Republicans alike in the 1990s said, we've got to prevent this these robber bearing class. So they passed the Sherman Antitrust Law in 1890. Then came Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster, stopping them. And then came an introduction of the American income tax in 1913. And what was so unique about this tax is that it only fell on 2% of the Americans. Only the very rich had to file a tax return. And who were the very rich? They were the monopolists, they were the real estate magnates, and most of all, they were the bankers and the financiers, who were trying to turn the economy into a trust economy, and who were trying to fight against government regulation, against government policy to shape an industrial economy. And so what Trump admires in the 1890s and the late 19th century is everything that ended this whole century-long development of an industrial philosophy and policy to enrich America. So he's admiring the dismantling of the dynamic of monopolization, of financialization, of anti-government legislation that is the opposite of what made America rich. That's what makes all of this so ironic.
Richard. Yeah. Here is what Donald Trump said about the why has he decided to pause tariffs on some countries. And we know that China is not one of them.
Because because you said that these tariffs would go into effect on Monday. You said no pause, but today there is a pause. So how can people believe your word today?
It's not a question of that. You have to have flexibility. I could say, here's a wall, and I'm going to go through that wall. I'm going to go through it no matter what. Keep going, and you can't go through the wall. Sometimes you have to be able to go under the wall, around the wall, or over the wall. These guys know that better than anybody, right? You got to go around them sometimes. You're not going to go through them. So I consider, you know, I think in financial markets, because they change. Look how much it changed today. We went from, pretty moderate today, but over the last few days, it looked pretty glum to, I guess they say it was the biggest day in financial history. That's a pretty big change. And I think the word would be flexible. You have to be flexible, like he's.
Richard, how do you characterize the U.S. donor class, as Michael was talking about, and its influence on policy?
Well, they seem to me to live in a fantasy world, that they can do things that clearly they can't do anymore. For me, the overwhelmingly interesting thing is, as I keep saying, that they live in a world in which the United States' economic, political, ideological, cultural, and military position are weakening. That's why the military strategists keep saying time is on China's side, not ours, in this conflict. But he doesn't want to face any of that. He's going to do this, that, and the other thing. No, he isn't. It isn't going to work for him. A declining empire does not have the options that a rising empire does. The last time we tried them with the tariffs was in a time of the rising U.S. empire. That's gone. That's over. We didn't have a major competitor on the scale that the Chinese are today back then. And by the way, Mr. McKinley got the tariff through when he was a representative. By the time he became a president, he turned against the policy of tariffs because he got into too much difficulty from the very class that Michael is talking about. Michael is right. There's no question that deep below all of the rest of this BS is a desire to avoid what for him is a catastrophe, which is the expiration of the tax cut that was passed in 2017. If that is allowed to expire, and that legislation has a self-ending, I believe on the 31st of December of this year. So if he doesn't get that problem solved, his donor class will get an enormous tax increase comparable to the one they decrease that they got 8 years ago. So he has to deal with that. And Michael is also right. He's promised more tax cuts on top of making sure that that other tax cut doesn't expire. And given that we are already projected to have almost a $2 trillion deficit now, he's looking at unbelievable risks of a bond market breakdown because people won't lend to the United States anymore because it's too dangerous to do. It is what happened to Liz Truss in England not so long ago. She tried to come up with a budget that looked like, oh, we will borrow more. No, said the bond market, we're not going to lend you anymore. And her proposal disappeared, and she disappeared. She's gone out of political politics. Out of politics in Britain. I don't make predictions, but Mr. Trump, who has had in the long historical sweep of things a meteoric rise to the top, could very well now be on the cusp of an equally meteoric rise down into oblivion because this doesn't work. There is an element here that people should understand. To the degree that people and businesses around the world lower their prices in order to hold on to the American market, despite the tariffs, then Mr. Trump will have achieved at least a part of what he's after. He will have made the rest of the world pay a tribute to the United States, because that's what it is. You want to do business here, you pay us. And the way you pay us is you lower the price of your exports here. That way the American people can keep buying them. The price will not go up. And the revenues from the tariffs will be paid to the American government. And it will be at the expense of the foreigners. They don't want it. They will be looking to every way to evade it. They will be likely to be successful. So the end result is that Mr. Trump will get a small portion of the fantasy he thinks is waiting there for him. That's, for me, what's going on. And again, they only get it if the rest of the world pays tribute. And that is going to make every other leader receive the rage and the bitterness of all those other countries who are being required to pay that tribute. And that's a wellspring of hostility that makes the United States, not China, the world's rogue nation in everybody's mind, U.S. allies and enemies alike. This is an extraordinarily risky ploy to undertake.
Yep.
Michael, we had some analysis in the mainstream media that it says that if iPhone, for example, iPhone is produced in the United States, it would triple the price of iPhone to $3,500. And how might Trump's tariff policies affect American labor and consumers?
Well, he could do that by rolling back history for 100 years or so. There's a reason that the United States is so expensive. And we've discussed that in the last few shows, that the economy's been financialized, that if a product is made in the United States, you have to employ American labor, and you have to pay it a living wage. And as we've discussed before, American labor has to pay enormous housing costs that are higher than those of any other country. It has to pay rising consumer prices, largely for products that have been monopolized, as the American economy has been. There's been a tax shift off the financial sector, off real estate, and off monopolies, off rentier income, onto labor. All of that has to be done here. The whole American neoliberal plan since the 1980s, Thatcherism, Reaganomics, and neoliberalism, has been to make money for the wealthiest 10% and above all the 1% at the expense of the American economy. So you've seen, as we've said before, since 2008, the 50% of Americans have a teeny share of wealth that has not increased at all. All of the increase in wealth since 2008, and really almost since the 1980s, has accrued to the 10%. This wealth has added to the cost of production for the 90% for the employers. And so if you look at how wonderful the stock market has been doing, see American economy is successful. Well, it's the stock market, because it's owned basically by the 10%, that's not the economy. The real economy is the employment of labor to produce goods and services, and that's become offshored and essentially financialized in a way that's increased the cost of doing business. So what Trump would have to do would be to have an industrial plan and say, my economic class, my donor class, has done it all wrong for the last 50 years. We've got to get rid of the donor class. We've got to restore progressive taxation and tax away all of their predatory income. We've got to tax away the real estate rent by a land tax. We've got to tax away monopoly rent by restoring monopolies as public utilities in the public domain so that they can provide their services at a cost or a subsidized rate instead of at the monopoly rates. We've got to have public health insurance so that people don't have to spend 18% of GDP on health insurance costs. And if employers don't have to contribute to their employee health insurance plan, they can lower the cost of production so that it's not going to cost so much to produce. The government can say, we can go back to the original democratic plan of public education. Everyone has a right to a college education at public expense, paid for by the rentier class, instead of having student debt that is so high that employers have, when they hire people, have to pay the employees enough to pay all the debt that they've taken on in order to get the job in the first place. All of these factors are what has made America a failed economy and a failed state. And in contrast to China, which has done exactly what the United States and other countries did to industrialize, there's a logic to industrialize. You want to increase labor productivity by increasing the educational status of labor, increasing its housing, lowering the cost that it has to pay for basic utilities. That's how China has made a low-cost economy. That's why Asian labor doesn't have to pay the wages that American employers have to pay, because they don't have to pay the medical costs, the housing costs, the monopoly prices that America has to pay. And the likelihood is that America's trade deficit is going to get over time much worse and will achieve exactly the opposite of what Trump says is going to do. Trump says that as a result of these tariffs, other countries are going to want to move to the United States to produce here to cut the costs. Well, there's no way that they can do that because he's sorting sort of Democles over the heads of foreign investors. If they are successful somehow, America's going to say, well, we're going to do to you what we did to China with TikTok. You've built a nice affiliate here. And now you've got to sell it to American investors so that we can buy it. We're forcing you to sell on national security grounds. Any dependency on a foreign investment, and that would include Volkswagen, BMW, Germany, if Trump decides that he doesn't like what Europe is doing. Everything is national security, meaning whatever the president wants to impose as a takeover to reward his campaign contributors by turning trade policy into a weaponized tool of foreign policy. Now, just imagine, I think we've said this before, if Volkswagen and BMW have relocated to the United States, Trump is now essentially forcing them to and to disinvest, because he said, well, we're going to impose high tariffs on the engines you make. Yes, you may produce the cars in the United States by adding to the chassis and putting on the tires and assembling them, but the largest cost of an automobile in the United States is the engine. And we're going to keep the taxes on the engines that you're importing, just like we do for Canada and Mexico. What Trump is doing is saying, we're going to prevent you from making the lower priced key to automobiles, the engines in Europe. And you're going to, on top of that, you're going to have to pay all of the high wage economy that we've created in America. But what's so ironic is the slogan for America's industrial takeoff that the protectionists used was the economy of high wages. And their idea was to make wages high in order to increase the productivity. Well, the problem is that the industrial capitalists didn't want to pay high wages. Say there was a pretty vicious class war in the 1980s, 1990s, and riots. That's what led to the Populist Party and to the ultimately to socialism. And so the government had a solution. It said, all right, you industrialists will not have to pay labor high wages. Labor is going to get high wages because we are going to have public investment to provide the services that labor needs to live. As I said, education, public health care, social spending, social structure, public subsidized transportation, public subsidized communication, all of these things, so that labor's living standards can rise without the industrialists having to actually pay more. Well, that was a mixed public-private economy, that with the government taking over more and more of the expenses and the provision of services that labor needed to increase its living standards, industrialists were able to avoid having to pay these costs themselves. Well, look at what privatization has done. By privatizing education, healthcare, communications, transportation, public utilities, they've been turned into monopolies, and their owners now charge monopoly rents on top of profits. And they've the financial sector has financed investment takeovers. They borrowed money to take firms private, or borrowed money just to take by control of firms, adding the debt service and interest charges that companies have to pay to provide hitherto public services. You have interest charges, you have medical insurance charges, you have monopoly profits, monopoly rents over and above profits. That's what's made the American economy so high priced. And without recognizing that what we're living in today is not the industrial capitalism of the 19th century, but the finance capitalism that's been put in place over the last 50 years that is makes its money by carving up and deindustrializing the economy, not by industrializing it. It's a whole different kind of capitalism that nobody in the 19th century imagined could actually develop to untrack the progressive line that industrial capitalism seemed to be taking prior to World War I.
Richard, it seems that Donald Trump and his Treasury Secretary are totally confused on the way that China has responded to the United States. How do you see the response coming out of China? Is that it's totally, we know that it's totally different from what it was in Donald Trump's first term. And what is that about the confidence in that China possesses right now? Is that about the huge changes, geopolitical changes that has happened during since then, or how do you see that?
Yes, I think that the Chinese have become much more confident because they ought to. It's the logical inference from what they have experienced. At least as far back as Obama, we know from the statements made by Obama, those around him, and everybody in power since, that we need to, quote unquote, pivot to Asia, that the American adversary now is China. And everything has been done imaginable, whether it's stationing the Seventh Fleet in the South China Sea or rediscovering this dead horse called Taipei, you know, Taiwan, and that issue, or the series of sanctions, the series of tariffs by Trump, then worsened by Biden. I want to remind people, Biden not only did not undo what Trump did, he raised it. In the case of the electric cars that I think I've mentioned before on our program, the BYD company's electric cars have 100% tariff. They've had it already from Mr. Biden. They didn't wait for this crazy last few days. 100% was already a Democratic contribution. And what do the last 10 or 15 years, because that's what it's been, 10 or 15 years of effort to slow, to stop Chinese growth. It has failed. It hasn't done that. China is a bigger and more powerful force now than it was 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, or 5 years ago. The alliance it has constructed, the BRICS, is a bigger alliance, more powerful than before. You know, the BRICS produce now about 35% of total GDP in the world, whereas the G7, the United States and its major allies, produce about 27-28%. And that gap is growing each year. The United States is not the dominant economic power anymore. That is the most, for me, the most important difference undermining everything. So yeah, the Chinese are very confident now, and you can see it. Their response to these tariffs is much more confident than the ones that they suffered, you know, in the first term of Mr. Trump when he did that sort of thing. It doesn't seem to work. They're able to maintain much faster rate of growth. I mean, the United States now has to even... And hence, I'll go back and bother Michael again by saying desperation. But, you know, when you turn on your allies in Europe and Canada and Mexico, that's another sign of desperation. You know, here's a little statistic to remember. The United States has 4.5% of the world's people. The BRICS alliance around China has 60% of the world's people. I mean, you need unspeakable advanced odds industrially and even militarily to offset that. That's not going to happen. The United States is losing each day that this continues. And around the world, the question really is, given that what the United States still has is perhaps a military preponderance. Although I must say the Ukraine war to date, which a couple of weeks ago the New York Times revealed has been a U.S. versus Russia war all along in terms of the level extent of American military control of operations over there, even that may be atrophying. We are not in a strong position, and that's what I see here. I see economic policy, you know, crazy stuff, Hail Mary passes, long shots that are taking enormous risks with very dubious chances of succeeding.
Okay, let's go with Richard's point of desperation and what they have to be desperate about. The problem, you can see, how can the United States recover its former international dominance if it's no longer an industrial power? If it's industrially dependent, it's as if it's a weaponized trade against itself. How can it recover dominance when it's become an international debtor, not an international creditor? And most of all, there's a moral issue here. The United States in 1945 was able to pretend that its self-interest in creating a new system of world trade, of world finance through the U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, they could say that this is creating a level playing field, the word they love to use, so that all nations are treated as equal. That's been the ideal of international law ever since 1648. And other countries thought that the United States was wealthy enough that it could actually afford to believe that in spreading democracy, meaning you have regime change to assassinate or remove any government that doesn't support the United States. Democracy, like you have in Ukraine under Zelensky, that somehow this was going to let other countries trust the United States. Trump has destroyed the trust in a way that is irreversible. Mm-hmm. What he said is that the United States has to be the gainer in every trade agreement or economic agreement or loan agreement or military agreement that it makes. Everything is a win-lose situation. Well, right after the initial market plunge, after he announced the enormous increase in tariff rates, he said, well, all of this is open for negotiation. And that, of course, is what he just said the other day. He said, well, all right, we'll give you 3 months. Well, I'm going to suspend the tariffs, and I've told you how much I can hurt you. That's what America has to offer the world. As we've said before, America has the ability to maintain the power it had in 1945 by its ability to hurt other countries, by weaponizing foreign trade, by weaponizing international finance, grabbing Russia's $300 billion of saving, grabbing Venezuela's gold, grabbing Iran's foreign reserves when the Shah was overthrown. Trump says, we can hurt you if you don't do what we want. Well, if other countries say any agreement we make with the United States, we're going to be hurt and we're going to be the losers, can't we try to make a different arrangement? There must be an alternative. Well, they've been trying for an alternative ever since the Bandung Conference in Indonesia in the 1950s under Sukarno. But as we've said before, they couldn't achieve an alternative because they didn't have a critical mass. Now, thanks largely to China's growth and also the post-Soviet growth of Russia, they have an alternative. This is why the United States says China is our number one enemy. The size and magnitude of China and its alternative economic philosophy to that of American and European neoliberalism is what makes it a threat, that for the first time now, other countries have an alternative. They can join together with mutual arrangements, and that's just what they're doing. You're already having Asian countries, South Korea, Japan, other countries trying to say, isn't there a way that we can trade with each other and do without the American market? Well, obviously, there's going to be pain in a 3 month or even 1 year changeover from trade with the United States to trade with each other. But now they see that mutual trade with each other, with the BRICS, with the global majority, with the global South, that are consolidating their trade, they don't need the United States because what Trump has done is in trying to isolate other countries by trying to divide and conquer every single country by making one deal with you, one deal with you, with having no unified tariff policy, but just what can we do to hurt each country in order? Other countries can say, we can make the kind of world that seemed to be promised back in 1945, a world of where countries are equal, where they follow the same economic rules, and where we don't have to go down the track that is untracked the American and European economies by financialization, monopolization, untaxing the wealthy and shifting the tax burden onto labor, and making America and Europe an uncompetitive, high-cost economy where only the 10% and the behind them the 1% are really able to suck up all of the wealth into their own hands. We can follow an economy that actually enriches our overall population, and that will make our whole economy, including the wealthiest classes rich. There will be, of course, there will be some millionaires and probably many millionaires, but these millionaires are going to be subject to social rules and structuring and tax policies that oblige them to use their wealth as part of a system of increasing the prosperity of the overall country, not using their wealth to take over other corporations, to raid them and become robber barons, not to try to take over government and privatize it and turn public services into opportunities for monopoly, but the kind of growth that really the whole 19th century of economists, from Adam Smith to John Stuart Mill, to the last great classical economists, Marx, all developed and explained. That's their alternative, and Trump has driven them together just like he's driven Russia and China together. His tariff policy and his threat to treat every other country as an economic opponent to be exploited so that he can end up the winner, his doing this has driven them together to finally seek an alternative. He's a revolutionist. That's the effect.
You know, two little amendments and then an inference from it. One of the great beneficiaries of every one of these tariffed countries around the world, as they try to evade, avoid, minimize the impact of their tariff on them, and they look for new trading partners in just the way Michael said, one of the first places they're going to go is China, because that's a place you can sell. That's a place that produces lots of things you need to buy. That's the biggest alternative to the United States there is right now. So if you cut off your connection, or even if you just reduce your connection to the United States, China will benefit, because they're going to be approached to do the replacement activity. And if they have half a brain, and they do, they will make good deals. They will take advantage. They'll give you a good deal this year, and maybe have to pay a bit more next year, but help you make the transition now. That's goodwill. That's political. I mean, just look at it. And if you wanted to wonder whether the replacement for the U.S. dollar, how it will be affected, it'll, of course, be speeded up. They've only made limited progress on that front. They talk a lot. They haven't done all that much. But this will be a spur, since more and more payments will be made without dollars because everybody's cutting back on dealing with the United States. That means the demand for the use of dollars, the need to hold dollars in reserves, in private accounts, in state accounts, in central bank. Come on, it's going to just speed up whatever steps need to be taken for alternative currencies to become normal in the world, other than the U.S. That's going to happen. And then finally, you know, the whole world is going to figure out. The United States currently has, last time I looked, 800 billionaires, running from Mr. Musk with 300 or 400 billion on down. Okay, 800 people. If you needed to sharply and dramatically reduce the deficit of the United States, simply taxing them such that everyone is reduced to between $1 and $2 billion. It means those 800 people will continue to be the richest people in the United States and likely the world. But the government will get, here we go, trillions of dollars to use to pay, to cover its bet to not have a deficit for the first time in many years, to have taken dramatic steps to make the United States more credit worthy. And even if they took the money that they got that way, used half of it to retire the deficit, reduce the deficit, and the other half to take all kinds of creative steps to enhance U.S. production, technology, productivity, technical education, all the things currently being cut. I mean, history will look back and say, you know, you actually could have changed the trajectory of your own decline, but you chose not to do it. You put into office leader after leader so beholden to the 800 billionaires that whatever you did had to leave them untouched by all of this. Giving yourself that constraint then hobbled you as to what alternative strategies you might have used. So you're your own worst enemy, because you can't do, in all likelihood, with your steps, what you could have done with those 800 who couldn't have done much about it. That's the irony of all of this. It's its own self-imposed constraints that prevent Mr. Trump, or for that matter, the Democrats, from even thinking about certain options. They've been so excluded from the beginning. That's when you see self-destruction. And the one common theme that most historians have when they look back on the decline of other empires is how easy it is to see what they could have done to prevent or slow that decline. And we all scratch our heads, why didn't they? And the answer is always their own political contradictions blocked them from either seeing or doing what they could have in fact done. And we're right there. And that is more evidence of a declining empire problem.
Well, Richard, what you've described is that America is facing a similar problem to what Putin faced with the domestic kleptocrats. How is he going to prevent the kleptocrats from taking over and doing what kleptocrats do? Well, he's at least done something to draw them in line. China faced a similar problem when you had Jack Ma, for instance, become so rich with his innovation. China sort of cut him down to size. But if the Americans would do that, it wouldn't be America. And you mentioned that Trump has ended up his own worst enemy. Well, there's a historical precedence for this in empires that you've just mentioned. In around the 5th century BC, the richest man in antiquity, Croesus, decided to increase his fortunes by attacking Persia. So he went to the temple at Delphi and said, I want to get even richer and conquer Persia and take over its gold to add to mine. And the Delphi oracle told him, you will destroy a great empire. And Croesus attacked Persia, was defeated, and it turned out the empire that he destroyed was his own.
Yes.
So that sounds pretty much what you've described for the United States. That's what happens to over-arrogant empires. That's what happens to hubris. And the wealthiest class, the donor class, the financial rentier class in the American economy combines hubris with the blind spot. They don't see what you and I recommend, that they would have to change who they are, because they say, well, that's who we are. We're not going to change who we are because we are who we are and we're in control. That is what has made the United States in danger of falling, or already has fallen into, a failed economy.
Well, you know, there's another way to put the same thing. And if you think about the remarkable fact, if I have this correctly, that there was a million Americans went into the streets this last weekend in many, many cities and towns across the United States to protest Trump's economic policies. I know here in New York City, where I live, there were very sizable demonstrations here. Okay, that leads to the joke that's circulating. But maybe that joke has a lot of serious implications. Here's the joke. The best recruiter for the American left today is Donald Trump. Well, let's expand it. Maybe the best recruiter for the left as an alternative direction for the whole world right now is Mr. Trump. He certainly is a world actor. He has gone from being the center of attention in the United States to making himself the center of attention everywhere. When I read the European newspapers the last few days, he's in the front page every day. He's now the center of attention everywhere, which many people who comment on his personality, I don't, but who do say is something that's very satisfying for him. May it be. I'm not interested, but I am interested in noticing that he is, whatever his intention, mobilizing the world as a critical mass and mobilizing the United States in a rather similar way. And that's more evidence that this may be a very, very transformative moment in American history.
And world history.
And world history.
Thank you so much, Richard and Michael. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Take care.